Okay, here we go. This is an interview with Erica Jolly, a long-time member of the Australian Federation of Australian Women, South Australia, now called the Australian Federation of Graduate Women, AFGW, or GWSA in South Australia, at the State Library of South Australia on the 5th of September 2018. The interviewer is Margaret Messenger. Thank you, Erica. I'd like to begin at the beginning. Can you tell me a little bit about your early childhood, where you grew up, and about your family?
I was born in 1933, 6 years after my mother and my father were married, after my mother went to Melbourne to see a doctor because her sisters-in-laws had kept telling her that men didn't like barren women and that men left barren women. And I was born 6 years later, and my brother was born 18 months after that. He died in 1937 because he loved golf and couldn't be bothered getting his shaving himself, and was shaved by a man who broke the boil, and he died of septicemia on his way back to Adelaide in Melbourne, because where they'd stopped to see my mother's family. So she was, 37. I was four, David was two and a half. And she tried to keep my father's chemist shop going, which is now Estia, in Henley Square, and of course couldn't. But I don't want to concentrate on that, because what matters for this oral history is incredible, unexpected connections that I have found since I was asked by Fliss Lord to join the publication group help bring into existence the story of what we now call Graduate Women South Australia. From its beginning, the initial idea was the concentration on the centenary from 1914 to 2014. But I was asked to join in, and I agreed to do so on certain conditions. One of which was that I had totally free hand, and that I would have the support of Michael Deaves, who has designed my books. And I would pay him $1,000 when he to do it, and usually his fee would be around about $2,500. But because he's published most of my books, and because he's probably one of the best book designers in Adelaide, I asked for his help. In the process of doing that, I have had incredible luck, I think, particularly when I went through the list of life members of SWSA. I gave up being a joiner when I came back from England. I'd been the founding secretary of the History Teachers Association, and I was on the history and social studies curriculum committees at the end of the 1950s and into the 1960s. I went to England, luckily, having got $1,000 for being hit in an accident. And when I came home, I thought, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to concentrate on getting a second degree. My first degree I got from Adelaide University in 1956, thanks to Hugh Stretton giving me a second chance, which I didn't deserve. But he gave it to me, so I ended up with an honours history degree.
What do you mean by a second chance?
I didn't work. I was lazy. And I was very lucky. At the Adelaide Teachers College, I had said to them, what do you want? totally failed ordinary degree Adelaide or a passed honours history degree, because I'd failed leaving botany. I either had to do a science. I loved botany, but we had a teacher who didn't teach any of the girls at St Peter's Girls, we were then in Commode Street, the chemistry. So all of us who did it with her failed botany. And if I didn't do the science unit, I had to do philosophy. And there was a hell of a lot of statistics in philosophy. And I'd failed intermediate maths twice. But there was this wonderful man at Adelaide Teachers College, and his name was Danny David. And when I said, you know, what do you want? And he just laughed and gave me a chance to do honours history. But as I say, I didn't work. And I just said to him, oh, you better fail me because I haven't done the work, blah, blah. But they said, no, sit for the exams. I sat for the exams. I did very well. They gave me a second chance to do another thesis. And I insisted on choosing my own subject for the thesis, and they let me. And I did it in my first year out teaching at Croydon Girls Tech. But when I got to that life list of the members of the Graduate Women, I began to see all kinds of connections with my life that are quite amazing for me. Before I mention that, I need to say that my vision of the Australian Federation of University Women, with its international connection with IFUW that was founded in 1919 after World War I, is broader than the vision of a significant number of its members. My vision is that the women who joined that organisation were not just interested in the provision of bursaries. And as I looked through that list, I discovered incredible things. This takes me back to the beginning. Mother, when she had to sell the chemist shop, first thought about the best education for David and me. You know, where are we now? It's 1937-38. And the top headmaster in South Australian public schools was a man named Walter Hutley, and he was at Rose Park Primary School. Mother bought an expensive house in 17 Hewitt Avenue, Rose Park, that was in walking distance. She had to get a job. It's wartime, so she was a clerk in the bank. Later, she had to divide the house and rent out half of it. And during World War II, it was rent control. And these people, who I won't name now, but by heavens, they're in my head, went to the rent control people to get the rent cut. And Mother couldn't afford to pay the mortgage, so she had to sell that incredible house.
Oh, that's terrible.
She then had to find a place that she could afford, and for the right kind of school for David and me.
Yeah.
So Hutley had left Rose Park. For some reason or another, the education department kept this man out in the country. He had the qualities of a poet. I don't want to concentrate on Walter Hutley, except that he keeps coming in. So he was now at Westbourne Park Public School, where Ruth Gibson actually taught for a while before she became an inspector. So Mother found this old late 19th century house that was falling down in 31 Kent Street, Hawthorne, that was in biking distance to Westbourne Park so that we could have Walter Hutley. Now, I spent part of grade six in a class with a woman named Miss Little, who was little of mind and little of stature.
Oh dear.
But in grade seven, I got this incredible, gentle, lovely woman. Of course, this is 1945. We're at the end of the war. We used to call her Fanny Ada Rogers. When I got that list of life members of Graduate Women,
she was there.
There is Frances Ada Rogers, born 1897, matriculates 1917. She looked very old to me. But when I think about it now, she's exactly the same age as mother. Yeah. And her gentleness, her capacity to help us think. She helped me to think about the war. She helped us to understand about current events and to examine primary documents. Yeah. I understood in grade seven the whole process of strategy in war.
It's amazing.
It's quite amazing. But she did it so gently and so well. And here she is, year after year after year, getting another subject, getting another subject, getting another subject. So that by 1927, she's got an arts degree from the University of Adelaide.
Right.
This is the woman who's teaching me. This is the woman who understood how good Walter Huttley was, because she let him come and take us out of mental arithmetic lessons to go and paint the almond blossom in Marlborough Street in July so that we could paint them before the petals fell from the almond blossoms. Here she is. Then, of course, I discover that another incredible South Australian educator named Anne Milne had known Walter Huttley. This is going to sound quite mad because the connections keep coming in the most peculiar ways. Anne Milne had come from Scotland. She was at Adelaide High, and she discovered that the Advanced School for Girls, which was set up in 1879, had these incredible women. Now, the tendency that I have found in Graduate Women is for the focus not to have been on the public schools. You came out of Woodlands. I came out of Saints. Brenda Nettle taught at MLC. Doreen McCarthy, who was this wonderful lecturer in biology, taught at Presbyterian Girls' College. Margaret Rillette was at Emmanuel College. There has been this incredible focus that seems to me to have ignored, well, it seemed to me, that's past tense. I changed my mind as I was discovering so much.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that there was this emphasis on the role of the independent schools in the development of graduate women, in the development of this organisation, that seemed to have left out the importance of education prior to higher education. But here I was discovering connections. Anne Milne had worked with Dr. Constance Davy, who was one of the first. Constance Davy is one of the people they bow down to in Graduate Women. She's in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. She was an early psychologist here. Anne Milne got connections with her. I'm not all that fond of Constance Davy because I'm not all that fond of the IQ testing that went on in the high schools to decide who was able and who was not able. But anyway, Anne Milne got on. They developed opportunity classes, which were all very, very good. Lo and behold, Anne Milne works with Walter Huttley, who is wanting to set up an opportunity class in Mount Gambier. Why is he wanting to set it up? One of his children had an intellectual disability. I discovered that I was going to write a biography of him. But there were reasons that I decided not to do it. I thought I might invade some very sad elements of his story. Both of his sons died during World War II. And he was dead the day that we declared victory against Japan in 1945, after pictures of the mushroom clouds were in the Advertiser. So at Westbourne Park, we stopped cheering.
Yeah. He died on
because
that day.
Because he was dead, yes.
Oh, that's terrible.
But anyway, 1927, he's setting up opportunity classes in Mount Gambier. Those opportunity classes were meant to be so that these children who were different in one way or another could work at their own capacity. Now, that of course didn't end up happening because they ended up being dumping grounds.
Yeah.
And convenient places where you put the kids who didn't fit easily into the mainstream classes.
Yeah.
But in 1966, they began to move them into the secondary technical schools as special classes so that these kids, some of whom could be up to 14 in grade 7 or 15 in grade 7, could get into secondary school with children of like-minded ages. So Anne Milne meets Walter Huttley and builds on his generosity of spirit in everything she did in early childhood education for this state. Colin Teeley describes her as one of the most generous women. Her influence on potential teachers can't be underestimated. So here's one of the connections coming out of this list.
Yeah.
Then, lo and behold, second connection, Mary Frost. Mary Frost taught me English from at Saints Girls. Mary Frost was a founding member of Women Graduates in 1914. Mary Frost was at one of their international conferences in 1946. She came back to Saints in 1947. And here, this school that was set up by the Anglican Sisters of Kilburn House to foster leadership in girls, I'm being taught. She used to get really irritated because I very often didn't live up to my potential. Here's this woman I'm discovering. Had been part of this and held official positions and went to a conference in London and all of this. Was bringing her commitment to girls in life through education at Saints.
And she taught you.
So here's Mary Frost coming in. Then it became incredible for me the more I went through that list of life members. And of course, Ruth Gibson is one of the very important members of Graduate SA. And they focus on what she did, and you know, and of course she's in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. But for me, what she did was what she was doing in the schools. And she was working in the schools, in the girls' tech schools, where there were all these girls that were despised as not being academic. You know, or their parents had decided they didn't need an education because they were going to be wives and mothers and housewives. And or their IQ tests had them down. Had them down. So here's Ruth Gibson fostering the women who were in these schools and the teachers and encouraging them to get their degrees while they were working. And lo and behold, who do I find in that life list? But Joan Young and Elma Gurney and Nancy Bartlett. Now, I'm going to ask you a question because your answer is going to affect where I go next. What do you think you were getting into when you became the president of Graduate Women South Australia?
Now I have to think back a little bit. At that particular time, when I became president, I was working in equal opportunity at Flinders University. And although I'd gone into that job as a fairly raw person, I didn't know a lot about it, but I learnt a lot by just doing things like the statistics, looking at the profile of the women in the university and where they sat, the academic, the technical, the administrative. I realised that women were not being able to reach their potential, they weren't getting the opportunities that men had, and I became quite passionate about supporting women, promoting women, and giving them the opportunities to reach their potentials in whatever field they happened to be in, you know. I found it just such a challenge, but just so exciting that I was actually involved in this. So when Daphne and Brenda Nettle asked me if I would join AFUW it was at the time, and I became involved, and then next thing they asked me if I'd be president. I wanted to do it because I thought, well, I actually have, you know, this is an organisation that does advocacy and promotes women, gives them encouragement, and I'd like to be part of it.
Oh, well, you gave me the right answer. Because when I was, remember I had given up being secretary of when I came back from England, and I was doing an MA at Flinders, but for me, while I loved Saints, and I was there because in spite of the fact that I was often absent, they eventually gave me a scholarship for 5 years to see if I'd do anything useful. But The independent schools before 1964 paid their own way. They were not subsidised by federal money. And because I went into, I had no sense then of antagonism towards private education, which I have got now. The 1955, because I still hadn't got the degree and I needed to stay in Adelaide to do the thesis that Stratton and Professor Duncan, they put me into a tech school. they put me into Croydon Girls Tech. It was probably the best thing they could have done, because I began to work with girls of incredible ability. Most of them were going to leave at 14. Mm. And that was the reason that I actually decided that it was much better to teach them social studies, which was an interdisciplinary approach with the economics, the politics, the geography, the starting from present and going back into past. If they went out of those schools with just the Reformation and the Renaissance, they were not going to get what they needed as women.
Great.
Mm. And so from Croydon Tech, Theberton, then as deputy principal at Elizabeth Girls Tech, I was finding again and again these girls who were either underestimated by their parents, or they didn't believe that they had stuff, but the calibre of those girls was so tremendous. And so for me, equal opportunity means what you provide that will enable them to get from the secondary level to the post-secondary level. And my friend Tess got me into this organisation in 1993. For me, I knew you from Flinders. Meeting Daphne was really important, because she actually believes in equal opportunity. She believed in it. She showed it in the most incredible way in her commitment to advocacy and the 1998 national conference. She got the money from Amanda Vanstone, also a product of St. Peter's Girls School.
Oh, right.
as is Julie Bishop.
Really?
Post Menzies,
okay.
Post the money going into private schools.
Yeah.
But she did something that had never been done in the national body before. She made the keynote speakers Aboriginal women. They were going to have the chance to tell us non-Indigenous women what they needed from us, instead of us telling them
what they needed,
what we thought they needed. Mm-hmm. Now, Daphne changed the whole focus. And we had moved in that direction a bit in 1993, because Loetta O'Donoghue, you see, the connections are amazing. Loetta O'Donoghue and Amy were at Colebrook House. They'd been courage taken from their mother. They were at Unley Girls Tech, who was one of their key teachers. Jean Andrews, one of the great contributors to Graduate Women SA and the National Council of Women. And she understood that the support for all girls, not just the high flyers, mattered. I knew Jean. She and my history teacher, Mrs. Paik, who also got the Tinlan Scholarship when she was Mary Reynolds, we used to travel on the same tram. You know, I knew Jean. And it was coming through this list of who, for me, are the graduate women who belong in this new book. Okay, in the first draft, Myra Lillywhite was there because she was a member of a music family. Myra Lillywhite founded Elizabeth Girls Tech High. She did everything she possibly could to help those girls advance. I didn't last there all that long because I was involved in a car accident. That gave me a bit of money so I could escape from Adelaide for a little while. But she, Myra, made that most incredible school. Then there's Joan Young. Now, Joan had worked at Croydon Girls Tech. Joan did an amazing thing. Those kids in the western suburbs didn't go into the city. She took these kids to the tennis at Memorial Drive. These little things that help expand horizons. Mm. That's the way you create equal opportunities. The focus that Daphne had, made it worth my while staying, because for me, yes, the bursaries are very important. Yes, they've done incredible things. But for me, that focus has always been too narrow. And so Joan Young founds Jepps Cross Girls Technical High School. Joan Young at Vermont Girls Tech recognises that Leanna Reed is amazing in science. Joan Young sees that, encourages her to go to the kind of academic school she needs to go to in her leaving and leaving honours. She goes to Flinders University. She ends up as Flinders University's first Rhodes Scholar. She ends up as a chief scientist. Where does she come from? Vermont Girls Tech. Who has she got? This life member of Graduate Women SA, taking her belief in girls into schools that were despised. If I had the energy, and I haven't got it, I would contact all former girls in Girls Techs and find out just how many of them got to university through TAFEs. Through TAFEs, Mary Ann Miner did, and she was a very important treasurer, and who've gone on.
And probably through, ultimately, the mature entry scheme.
Yes.
When, you know, the mature women came, and they were just mothers who had probably only a basic technical high school education, suddenly the opportunities, they got free university education.
Thank you, Gough Whitlam.
Thank you, Gough Whitlam, and gave them the scheme which trained them how to sort of write essays and
thank you, Daphne Elliott, Foundation for Science and Mathematics.
And they went into university and did brilliantly. Many of them went on and did PhDs, didn't they?
That's absolutely so. Yvonne Miles, who went to Theberton Girls Tech and who was very annoyed with me for not recognising her talent, got a PhD in Australian literature from Flinders as a mature age student. Mm. I want to finish this bit though.
Yes.
Nancy Bartlett.
Yeah.
Is what I have learnt just through reading that list of life members. Nancy Bartlett, I've got to go back one. Elma Gurney. I was never all that fond of Elma Gurney, but I am now. Elma Sevington Gurney had a Bachelor of Science. She became science teacher at Croydon Girls Tech. There she encouraged the girls to stay at school for 4 years and sit for the PB, even if it only meant they could be primary school teachers or nurses. One of the girls she taught was Margaret Oak Grant. She gave her extra lessons in physiology. That girl, as a woman, founded AIR Technical High School in Whyalla. What Elma did for her had such ramifications. It might not have produced a girl that would earn a bursary, but what they were doing were broadening horizons. You know, all the time. Elma then became head of Norwood Girls Tech. She did incredible work while she was there. Then she became an inspector. As an inspector, she encouraged the development of music for all kids in schools, not just special schools. You know, and what's more, she encouraged new maths, with which the traditional mathematicians just destroyed. We could have been thinking in lateral ways as well as linear ways if the whole new maths program that was being fostered at the University of Adelaide wasn't undermined by people like inspectors like Glastonbury. Elma saw the need for a range of possibilities. Now, when she became an inspector, the person who followed her was Nancy Bartlett, and Norwood Girls Tech, that was combined with another school and became Kensington Girls Technical High School, and Nancy Bartlett brought kids together in the most intelligent. She was a very gentle head. She was a very gentle, lovely head. And she was on the Pan Pacific Committee for Graduate Women. And she was on the official committee. Now, for me, the people who matter are involved in a way that moves beyond university. Am I making sense?
Yep, I'm understanding.
So, that takes me back to 1993. What was happening in Australia when the Hawke government came in was the establishment of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Council.
Yeah.
Lowitja O'Donoghue, product of Elizabeth Girls Tech and of a state that would not allow her to be a nurse because she was Aboriginal.
Really?
Absolutely. It becomes a political fighter for Aboriginal people. She's made the first chair of ATSIC. She develops this guide to have another look at Australian history. Judith Weston is president.
Hi.
Jenny Ward. Mm-hmm. Hedy Schweck. Mm. Mari Locke. And me. We study that guide.
Yeah.
We have this study group. Study that guide and reach the conclusion, which I found lovely because it was an incredibly mixed group, you know, very conservative and less conservative. The point that was reached, and it was Jenny who actually expressed it, there has been no effort at conciliation, so reconciliation is not the process. We consider that a treaty with Aboriginal people should be the way the Australian government could. Graduate women, I say, reached that point in its thinking in 1993. Mm. No other chapter, not the national body, reached that level of thinking in 1993. The Padlet and Dadlew bursaries. Yeah. If Brenda Nettle hadn't, it's my view this is, if Brenda Nettle hadn't spoken as well as she did at the National Conference in Sydney, I wasn't there, the national body mightn't have joined the reconciliation movement.
Really?
Really. But, you know, Brenda pushed that. Brenda pushed the Padlet and Dadlew postgraduate bursaries for research and coursework. And it took us longer. It took us till 2004 to put in the Padlet and Dadlew undergraduate bursary. Now, for me, all the work we did from 1993 to 2016 had value because we were moving in a way towards equal opportunity. For me, that was what mattered. Okay. Some people, I think I pushed it too hard.
They always think that about the forerunners.
Well, my concern is that the focus in the book on bursaries will not give the significance to that change in thinking that I think it warrants. Daphne gets federal money from DEACHA for a national conference at the University of South Australia. Who are the keynote speakers? Jackie Huggins.
Yeah, I remember Jackie.
Dr. Jackie Huggins. Veronica Arben, a woman from Western Australia, I've forgotten. Maria Lane from the University of South Australia, who was bringing Aboriginal kids in from Sejuna, you know. She had an auntie, a non-Indigenous auntie, in Port Lincoln, who helped them to begin the process of writing academically. She would get her work was undermined later at UniSA, but I don't want to go into that here. But she insisted, as they all did, that the barriers were in the secondary schools. If they could be got, if those barriers could be got rid of, and their chances and all of the other things, you know, being shamed, you know, being made to feel inadequate, all of the other things that white Australia set in place, then their opportunities in higher education would be real opportunities. And of course, who are two of the winners of Padlet and Dadlew bursaries? She's now Dr. Ali Gamelia Baker. She's at Yungerendi.
Okay.
Flinders setting up Yungerendi.
That's right.
Is really important. Ali was doing work in visual visual education for a master's. And she's now got a PhD. I think her name was Kath O'Donnell. She was with Fran Baum in public education. Not too many people have applied for those bursaries. But the fact that they were there, and the fact that Graduate Women SA led the way, I think belongs in this book.
Indeed, yeah.
And my concern is that it won't be in this book.
Why is that?
Because they're only concentrating on bursaries. The depth of real advocacy that we were doing in these areas, and the incredible work that those women are doing in schools, don't seem to matter to some. And that...
When you say they don't seem to matter, it's because they don't think it's relevant to the book.
That's right, you got it. They don't think it's relevant to the book.
And this does matter.
Yeah. It does matter. They don't think it's relevant to the book. That's it. This is the difference between, in my view, this is the difference between the original vision of IFUW, the education of women to improve the communities and for peace immediately after 1919. And it's the view of a significant number of people in the national body as well. Mm-hmm. Now, who's the key to that? It's Jennifer Strauss. In the national body, Jennifer was doing the fighting for this broader approach that Daphne achieved in that conference. Yeah. However,
so Jennifer's view is that it should be included as well.
Oh, Jennifer has no say, and of course she thinks it should be included.
So why does she have no say?
Because it's the publication committee, the little group that was set up here, that brought Diana Chettle in to help them get going, and then Felicity, of course, brought me in to. And when I came in, I considered that the focus had to move beyond the bursaries.
Fair enough.
One of the reasons I'm doing this with you is because I want documentation in the oral history of the change in our approach to advocacy from 1993.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. I think it should be written down. It should be acknowledged. And so it's good that you're saying that. I hope that you get your way. But
I won't get my way.
You won't?
No, I won't.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that, Erica. Very sorry to hear. So how far down the track is it?
It's a long way down the track. And it's also a question of how much I'm prepared to fight. And I'm not prepared to fight too much because I want the book to exist. Mm. Yeah. You understand what maddens me is that it is not under. No, it's not just about an organisation. Mm. It's about the people who joined it. Not all of them joined it just to put money into bursaries. They joined it because they believed in the aims.
And they wanted to contribute.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In their different ways.
In their different ways. I agree with you. I think that's the big thing, is that the different input by different people according to their skills and abilities and their vision. And not everyone's vision is just to raise money for bursaries.
No. Yeah. And in fact, they didn't start doing that until 1939. And they only began to set up South Australian bursaries in 1969. Because they were supporting the international bursaries and the national ones. Mm. South Australia did incredible stuff.
Yeah.
And it all has to be valued. Mm. But it is as if the role of teachers in all that preparatory stuff, you know, Anne Milne in early education, Gwen Fulton is a member, and she, as women's warden at Adelaide Teachers College, was brilliant, you know. Oh!
And of course it's those women who are the role models for the younger ones coming on, when they see what they have done and what they can achieve, when they get the encouragement from them to go on and do more, and who actually say, you can do it, when they've grown up with that feeling of inferiority, I can't do it, I could never be an academic, I could never do this. To have those role models at that early age, when they're in primary school and secondary school, is what can take them out of it into the new sphere.
Well,
that is the really important thing, because...
Well, what Jackie Huggins said at that conference, she wanted to do secondary education. She, because she was in Brisbane, some teacher told her that her brain would never be good enough because, you know, there was some kind of biological inferiority in the brains. Who helped that woman to realise that she had it? A lecturer in education at Flinders University. Mm. You know, and she told us this. Now, we used to get Aboriginal women to come into our meetings and talk to us, right at the time when our audiences were declining, by the way. But Leanne Liddell had the same experience, because she'd started out as a police officer and got treated very badly, and she got a degree at Flinders. And at the time she was talking to us, she was a co-director of the National Parks. Her mother, and she lived in Alice Springs, her mother was told that that the girls should get out of school early so they'd get a job because they'd never be able to do anything. Her mother insisted that all of her children, her daughters, should have the full secondary education so they should have every opportunity. The power of the white Australian attitude. I'm a bit hung up on this because of situations in my mother's family. The husband of my mother's younger sister, Ethelwyn, was 16 years younger than mother, Victor Hugo Wallace, who turned out to be the secretary of the Eugenic Society in Melbourne from 1918 to 1968. It was still in its magazine was still in existence after the referendum. And that explains the attitudes towards the Asian boyfriend of my lovely young cousin. And of course, they were very unhappy when my cousin Diana, back in the 1960s, married a Muslim in the mosque in Adelaide.
Oh, okay.
It must have really hurt him, you know, because here were his children. But his influence had terrible effect. So maybe I'm a bit obsessive about this now, because I understand just what that kind of pseudoscience was doing to the outlook of the of white Australia.
It was white Australia too. I mean, I grew up towards the end of all of that, but my mother and her cohort and generation, they were absolutely, you know, I mean, that was their thinking, their brainwashing and everything else. I mean, I couldn't remember, and I have to take it with great shame, my mother saying that the Aborigines would die out and that they would be inbred or, you know, would have bred out, and that, you know, within generations there would be no Aborigines in Australia. And, I mean, she believed that because that's what she was taught. And I grew up, and I think the first Aboriginal person I saw was when I was teaching at Woodlands and we had someone came down from Darwin as a boarder.
Well, I was lucky.
And I never saw one before that.
I was lucky because being in the tech school, it's Everton Tech.
Oh, right.
I was teaching Aboriginal kids, Aboriginal girls. And I remember with great love, Sandra Lovegrove, and Avis Gale wrote about the protectors, and she was called Wild Dog by these protectors, and she'd been taken from family, but this takes me back to that line in that list of life members of that graduate women was a woman named Diana Allen. Mm-hmm. Now, Diana Allen taught at Everton Girls Tech. Diana Allen was a very gentle creature, and some of us didn't value her nearly, I'd include me in that, nearly as much as we did, but Avis did, before she was taken away by the protectors. Avis said that what Diana Allen gave her was the capacity to budget, how to use money, so that she wouldn't just fritter it. Do you need this much for this and need this much for this? And she, to me, she thanked Diana Allen for giving her the capacity to budget. Here's this woman in this list of life members. Now, there are loads of others of them. Esther Messant was a president. She established Saltash College. She was a brilliant English teacher. She taught my brother when Unley High School was going to fail him because he'd failed second year by half a mark. Mother had taken David and me because she, how was she going to educate us when she had so little money, war's going over, men are coming back, she's losing her job in the bank, she's lost that beautiful house. How's she going to help? How's she going to cope? She takes us to the Women's Hospital, Women's Children's Hospital, to Mary Smith, child psychologist, where we have our IQ tests done. Not those damned IQ tests they did in the schools, which you never knew if the arithmetic was right anyway. And both of us were over 130. David was one more than me.
Why did she take you to have IQ tests?
Because she didn't know. She wanted to do the best for us.
Oh, okay. She wanted.
She didn't. She's a Victorian. And she left school early. She'd got. She was a typist. She got some schooling at Scots Business College here. She's wanting to do the best for us. So, and she thinks she just has to find out how good we are.
Okay.
You know, Who's Mary Smith?
Yeah.
One of the members of Graduate Women South Australia.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And she, and Mary Smith, of course, is in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. It's, you can see what keeps coming up.
Yeah, yeah.
In what I keep finding. Now, what she was doing for Mother, she actually suggested a number of things about what we could, what kind of people we would be or we would go. And I was very lucky that I got that scholarship to Saints, because I would have failed an IQ test. One of the other ones, I was capable of failing everything.
Eric, I can't believe that.
Oh, no, I do. I do.
I'll never see you as a failure.
I don't either, because I learn from failure.
Oh, no, I think we all learn by our mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, it doesn't have to be called failure, but sometimes we take the wrong, or make the wrong decisions, but you learn from that. That's
yes,
right. And that's some of the best lessons in life, isn't it?
But I know I can see just how I would have gone. Ian, I just wouldn't have. I don't know what I would have done, but I wasn't good at anything like that. Mm. I just. I don't understand why, but I wasn't. Mm. Discovering all of what I was thinking about Mary Smith is. What she was doing for Mother, she was doing for an incredible range of people. That's 1945 I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, helping people to find different waves through life. Now she's valued here.
Yeah.
Because, of course, she's in the Australian Dictionary of Biography, isn't she? I value her for being there when Mother needed, because she was a Victorian living in Adelaide, which is another problem, of course. I'm glad she chose Adelaide.
Yes, I think, you know, when I look, you were really very, very fortunate, because today the population is so big that the Mary Smiths would be hidden away and not everybody would have the opportunity to consult with her, whereas your mother could find somebody like her and she was available. But today, would it be so easy?
And she found Walter Hutley. Yeah. And she found Walter Hutley at Westbourne Park. And I find Frances Ada Rogers at Westbourne Park. I think my luck's extraordinary.
Yeah.
Extraordinary.
Those people, you know, it wouldn't be so easy to find those people today, would it?
No, and another bit of luck, in its funny kind of way. when I came back from England and I wanted to change discipline, and I wanted to study English, because in England, they, even though my knowledge of British history was better than most of theirs,
I think
they
so
thought
funny.
I couldn't, and they got me to teach English, which I wasn't good at. But anyway, I wanted to study literature. I came back and I went and completed the major in English at Adelaide University, and I wanted to do honours. I wanted to work on romantic poetry. And Professor Colmar couldn't be bothered with a mature-aged student.
Really?
So they said, go up to Flinders University and see what they'll do for you there. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Hmm?
You know.
Yeah.
And Flinders put me through the hoop. How many subjects did I have to do to prove that I could do an MA in English literature?
Hmm.
They were all wonderful. I had to do Commonwealth literature. I had to do American literature, from Jonathan Edwards right up to Saul Bellow. I had to do... studied the Romantics and criticism. I had to do four units to prove that I could be deemed to do an MA.
How long did it take you to do that?
2 years.
And you were teaching at that time?
No, I stopped.
You weren't teaching.
I stopped being a deputy principal. I was deputy principal at Mitcham, which goes into the story in another way. But I gave it up. I went back to half-time teaching so that I could study. And Mother was perfectly happy for me to have half or leave and less than half of a salary, because she loved seeing me studying. Mm. She was at her happiest when I was studying. But no, it was the best thing that could have happened to me, because as an adult student, I wasn't scared. I'd go in and sit and talk to a lecturer and Professor Jean Lemire. I'd say, can I come and sit in on your lessons in Victorian literature? Of course you can. And they would come down and talk to my kids at Mawson High School,
really?
And at Marion High School. Humphrey Tranter came down and talked to my kids when Brighton Boys Tech became the co-educational Mawson High School. Jean Lemire came to talk to my kids at Marion High School. When I set up a weekend program, or tried to, at Marion, I got poets from Flinders and a top bloke from the education department. And this was, of course, before, this was when their time out of the university was counted as part of their allocation.
Oh, really?
Yeah, later on it wouldn't be counted. Okay. Some of them stopped doing it.
I see, right. Mm. So it was through you doing that, your honours or masters there, that you ultimately were invited to be on the school council.
Yes.
Obviously, university council, Flinders University Council. And how did you find that? Being a woman.
Well, this is very funny. In staff rooms in schools, I have found, or had found, past tense, that teachers didn't know how to talk to parents. At Mawson High School, when we made the comprehensive school, we made certain that parents were valued. It was very much an open school for a little while, until we got a headmaster who didn't value anything like that. And the I was asked to stand for election to be the graduates rep
on council.
On council. And I got it in 1990. And of course, they weren't used to having an outsider on council. And so I don't think council at Flinders now is nearly as open to all of the people who are part of the university as it used to be. That's putting it as, it's more like a business council than an academic council now. So I used to sit pretty close to the student rep and the international student rep, and usually there were empty seats either side of me, because they wouldn't know where to sit. So the latecomer had to sit there. So I gradually realised that what was happening to me in that council was what we did to parents in school staff rooms. Teachers en masse didn't seem to know how to talk to parents.
And the staff, academic staff, didn't know how to talk to the graduates, or the student reps.
The student rep. So I just said to him one day, I said, I understand. We're the microcosm of you. You know, you're happy with other academics. You are not happy with outsiders. I was an outsider. luckily, of course, Deirdre Jordan thought I was useful. So I was part and parcel of the...
She included you.
Oh, absolutely. And so did John Lovering. Mm. He put me on the planning committee to the fury of some and kept me there.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when Ian Chubb came, he put me on the Academic Senate. And on the Academic Senate, of course, there was Ian Gibbons, who, you know, when I would ask a question and some people would roll their eyes to heaven, Ian would say, well, I think Miss Jolly has a point.
He'd support you.
Mm. Well, yeah, he supported me absolutely, as my cello did later on. But it's a very good university.
I think that was true in many ways. There were some people, some staff, not all, who were extremely supportive of not only the student body, but the women, because it was a real problem. That early council was all men, and the odd woman who was called the token woman, and the token woman couldn't even open her mouth without being just ignored or shot down in flames. I don't think they actually just talked over.
Yeah.
I found was really interesting as, well, people like Ian Gibbons was really, really supportive, and as you say, Marcello was another one, where they would actually listen. You'd make a suggestion or a comment and then back it up. Eventually, when we got more and more women on council or academic senate or planning committee, whatever it might have been, got past that critical mass of 30% or whatever it might be, suddenly the women were able to speak and be listened to.
Mm.
And I noticed that change, that you needed to have that critical mass of women before what they said was actually interpreted as making sense and a good suggestion. But those, I suppose it was quite courageous of the men, those people like Ian, who were prepared to support the women and in the face of all the others who felt uncomfortable with women on committees.
Well, it was quite amazing when Lovering had me on the planning committee.
Yeah.
And I think it's John Keeves he was emeritus at School of Education, and someone suggested to Lovering that they didn't need me anymore because they had John Keeves, because he was from School of Education, you see, and I was I was secondary education, you know, this division between the thinking of higher education and pre-tertiary education still bugs me.
Mm.
But Lovering refused to take me off the council, off that planning committee.
Mm.
And I thought that was courageous.
He was. He was. John was very good. I don't think he was the best of the vice chancellors we had.
No.
But he was the first proper boss, if you like to call it, because equal opportunity reported to the vice chancellor, not to the registrar or head of the administration, which was always a bone of contention. But John Lovering, I think partly through his wife Kerry.
Yes.
Kerry was just helped John think along those lines and be supportive of women. And he was very good to me over a whole range of things where I certainly didn't get support from other areas. And John, well, for one thing, they tried to get me to report to administration because, of course, administration could cut me off at a much lower level. If I reported directly to the Vice-Chancellor, then things that I recommended we needed to have done, he would agree to, and then it would have to be done. But if I made a recommendation in administration and the bursar, not the bursar, the registrar, decided no, well, then that was it, finished, you know. And I had to fight to keep my reporting, and John supported me on that one.
I go on a lot about my luck, you know, the sheer luck that that I get aware of. And there's another thing I'd like to bring in before we finish. These women who are acknowledged and done all this massive work for bursaries, things we need to remember about them is they were teachers. Brenda Nettle taught maths at MLC.
Yep.
Doreen McCarthy taught at Presbyterian Girls' right. College. Ellen Benham, this incredible science woman who taught at the Advanced School for Girls, who came out of a public school and taught at the Advanced School for Girls, took over Walford, you know. And Brenda's daughter, Mary Nettle, who was always been a member of this organisation, taught Heather Latz in Leaving. She also taught at Marion High School when I was deputy principal to Brian Hannaford. And we had a couple of male maths teachers who, let me say, were limited. Mary took her maths students up into the hills to examine plots of lands for the percentage of weeds as against the natural flora. You know, the men never took them out of their classroom except when they took them up to Flinders for big lectures. Mary did incredible things. And she also ran the Women's Research Centre until it was got rid of. So, yeah. The assumptions that the teachers have to be lesser in this picture strikes me as odd.
Did you know that I taught at Woodlands and taught at MLC?
Yes, of course I do, because so I interviewed you.
That's right. So I taught at both those schools as well. And it was amazing that some of the students that came out of those schools, those girls that were really, really good, they went on to do, you know, higher education, medicine, science, and things. It was, you know, I always felt very proud of the fact that I'd had a little hand in their education.
Well, I'm grateful for the fact that a number of the people I taught, a number of the girls I taught, a number of the boys I taught still value my contribution to their education. And one of them is now a senior lecturer in geology at the University of Sydney, Adriana Dukiewicz. But her story is incredible. Not able to speak a word of English in year 8 when she comes to Marion High School, but writes a letter to William Golding about the Lord of the Flies in year 10 that Jennifer Strauss would say would get a credit at first year university.
Really?
And when I taught her in year 12, she understood and loved King Lear, and she values me. And I very much value her. But you don't know. You just have to hope that somewhere you didn't do damage.
And that's, I suppose, what we all of us don't know. You know, we all try to do our best, and we hope that we haven't ever done anything that's been damaging to their growth, personalities or whatever. I always like to think that I could have been a good role model. But I don't know about the bad stories about me because nobody's ever told me. And I guess that could happen to all of us, couldn't it?
Yeah, Thene Badhams.
Oh, yeah.
There's a bursary for her and she did incredible work. But who's Thene Badhams? Thene Badhams comes out of Teachers College. and becomes head of Woodlands, of course, becomes head of Woodlands. Theeny Baddams brings in two graduate women, Ruth Worthy, Wordley. I taught with her. She was at Brighton High, I was at Morton, and we collaborated. I was very fond of Ruth. She had six children. She only goes back to teaching when the youngest child is at primary school. And she was doing in an academic high school what a number of us were doing in what were the former separate boys and girls techs once they became comprehensive after about 1974, most of them. The connections just keep going.
It's really interesting. Do you think it's just because it's South Australia and we're small, or do you think it's the GWSA that brought them all together, was the tie, the common link between them all?
Well, it's the common link I keep finding. Mm. And it keeps saying to me, right through the whole of it, oh, and I haven't mentioned Helen Northey. God, right through the whole of it, there is this thread of women who believe it is important to educate people, women, the best they possibly can, so that they can succeed in society.
Reach their potential.
Mm. Yeah. May not be through higher education and PhDs. Yeah. It may simply be that as mothers, they say, my daughter is going to have more chances than I did. You know? But the thread is in there.
Yeah.
Okay. Graduate Women SA legally ceases to exist in 2016. But the Australian Federation AFUW SA Trust Fund still exists. My view is that trust fund comes out of the parent body, and that even though legally the parent body no longer exists in 2016. Symbolically, it does, because the trust fund wouldn't have been there if the parent body hadn't been there in the first place. And I refuse to see the Australian Federation of University SA Trust Fund as totally separated from a Graduate Women SA.
So where does Graduate Women SA, which no longer exists, how does that...
It's symbolically.
It's just that...
It's the idea. The idea is there. Mm. That you are... These bursaries are to foster the advancement of women.
Indeed.
So the... The thread I've been talking about, this intangible thread, will continue so long as the AFUWSA Trust is funding bursaries.
And who's managing that now?
A separate trust fund. It was legally separated from it. This is very useful information that's in the book as to why the trust fund became a separate entity.
Yeah.
It became a separate entity because the Australian Taxation Office wanted to get the money that NGOs were not paying it. And so the structure of NGOs was changed in 1989. And to make certain that the AFUW, the organisation, could go on providing bursaries as it had been through the Goods and Gowns thing, it had to change its structure. Now, in changing its structure, they made certain that all of the money from the hoods and gowns went to the bursaries from 1989 on. Until the University of Adelaide decided to set up its own gowns program.
So where's the money for the bursaries come from now, if it's not hoods and gowns?
It comes from the incredibly brilliant work of Brenda Nettle and Heather Latz between them. And of course, Brenda taught Heather at MLC. Mary had taught Heather at MLC. It's all there. It's really her brilliant work. Plus Mary Ann Minor.
Yeah.
Mustn't be left out of this. Set up an absolute separate account so that the money had to be there. We continued to exist on whatever we got from a declining membership. By the time they had $720,000 cashed away in their account.
Wow.
And of course the interest levels had gone down. Mm. So that's the basis and the interest that they have grown on since 2016. The bursaries that they provide are much smaller in amount, but they're still being provided. And they're going to incredible things, like a woman named Nina James at the University of South Australia, who's doing all this work on citizen science.
All right.
Yeah. And another woman who got the Winifred Preedy Bursary, who's working on preventative oral health in dentistry. They've only just begun to set up a master's in really? The oral health in dentistry.
Really?
Yeah. It is still fulfilling a function that was set up for it by the parent organisation. And I refuse to see it
separated.
Technically, legally, it is. Mm. Intellectually, the line is there.
Yeah. And the recipients need to know the origin of it. The recipients need to know the origin of it all, rather than just apply for a bursary.
Yes. Well, when the book exists, the reason I support the book, and I do, and whatever comes out, I'll support. In my way, but the reason is just that. Someone said that there's no need for this because the information is either at the University of Adelaide or it's here in the State Library, because all of the oral histories are here. Mm. But it's scattered, and it'll be good if someone wants to do some research on it, but there is no felt connection with how it came about, unless you put it all together in the book. What I don't want left out, that there will probably get a minimal amount of acceptance in it finally, is the advocacy role, particularly that change in our attitudes from the 1990s on.
That's really sad, isn't it?
Well, one has to, when you reach my age, one has to decide where your energy is going to go. And I thank you very much for interviewing me so that I can use my energy positively in this.
Well, Erica, thank you very much for allowing me to be the interviewer. And I found your talk today really, really interesting. I mean, you've enlightened me on a whole range of areas of AFU or GWSA.
which I have found most interesting, and I look forward to the book, however it turns out, but I hope it comes to fruition. And I hope.
It will come to fruition.
Well, yeah.
It will.
But I would be very disappointed too if the advocacy role is left out, because I always saw that as...
It'll be there, because, one very good thing I only learnt the other day, don't do that. It's going to be dedicated to Daphne Elliott.
Oh, that's lovely. That is lovely. I think that's a very worthy dedication, very worthy. She was an amazing woman, wasn't she, in so many ways. She taught me, did you know that? When I did my degree at Flinders, went back to Flinders, because I dropped out of uni originally. Then when I decided I needed a paper qualification, I went to Flinders, because they would accept me. And Daphne was my tutor in biology. And first time I met her, but she impressed me enormously right from the very beginning. In many ways, through my biology degree, she was a role model, because she was a mother, she had children, she was working, and I don't know, she just had some sort of presence that I found very hard to define, but she was always there, she was a wonderful tutor.
She was always calm.
Calm, supported. Mm-hmm. And
she loved me. She used to send me cards, and if I felt irritated.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. She'd help me to see something through. And so would Catherine Seymour, who was that lovely young youth liaison. Mm. Yes. No.
You know what Ian Chubb said about Daphne Elliott when she was going for promotion, because she was so badly treated.
She
was a senior tutor and she couldn't get through the glass ceiling to become into the academic, the lecturer thing. And there was all this fuss. I can't believe why people were so unkind. But Ian Chubb said one time at the promotions committee, said, if Daphne Elliott's name had been David Elliott, Daphne Elliott would be Professor Daphne Elliott today. And I just thought, having my experience of her from back in those old days when I'd done my degree, I thought, how true, that she was just never allowed through because she was a woman. And
do you know one of the other reasons? Hmm? Someone on the council, someone said, there's no need for her to have superannuation because her husband's a professor at the University of Adelaide.
Yeah, I can remember that. And they said, she's only going for promotion because she might work, so she can get a superannuation.
Yeah.
How cruel. It was unbelievable. And that was the sort of attitude that she had to face, and many women had to face, and which is why I became very passionate about equal opportunity. I just thought there are so many good women who have been kept down, and for all those trivial reasons,
yes,
it's unbelievable.
Before we finish, there's someone else I want to mention. I want to mention Dr. Jennifer Barker.
Oh, yes.
Because without Alison MacKinnon had the idea for a recording early graduates for her book. It was Dr. Jennifer Barker who set up the Oral History Project.
Aye.
And it was Jenny also, who fought like mad. It's not just Brenda, it's Jennifer as well, to make certain that the scholarships and bursaries money was not frittered by us. We operated on the smell of an oily rag, you know. When you and I did the newsletters,
that's right. Yes.
You know, and we were just sort of doing our best to keep going.
Yeah.
We were operating on this minuscule amount of money because Brenda and Jennifer set it as strongly as they possibly could to protect that bursary's money from us. My friend who got me into this organisation, and I, because I hadn't intended to join any more organisations, Tess Young, Tess gave up because she couldn't get money for publicity. Getting money, they protected that bursary and scholarships money extremely
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm. And that's a very good thing, because
it's
still working.
And it's still there. Yeah. Mm. That's fantastic. Mm. Well, should we conclude this interview?
Yes.
Erica, thank you so much for doing all that, for all those words. I'm sorry that you have to now translate them but onto paper, but it's been, for me, it's been a very interesting experience, so I thank you.
Well, I thank you for letting me do it, helping me to do it, because it's...
Well, it's a record, I think, that we need to have, and presumably in the future, maybe in years to come, when we're long gone, there'll be somebody researching out there, and they'll come across this, and they'll find it really interesting.
I'm absolutely hoping that that will happen, because this organisation... was despised by some of the professionals. I tried to get a friend of mine who was in the School of Education to join this organisation. And she, of course, she was academic by that time and in with her professional organisations. And she said two things. One was that one couldn't be a member of everything. Mm. And the other thing she thought was that this organisation was too conservative. It wasn't progressive enough. Now, it did very important things, and I think it should be well and truly remembered for all of those things. Yeah. Talk about... didn't have a clue.
Well, maybe she didn't know much about it, but I mean, it was, I suppose, of its time, it was conservative, because that was the
it was
the environment in which it grew up. But, you know.
But Daphne took it out of that.
The members, that's right, the members changed, and as they had new members and times changed, so attitudes changed and beliefs and everything else. So it didn't have to stay conservative.
No, and it didn't stay conservative. Mm.
And when the advocacy role came in, then it couldn't be conservative.
No. But without that 1998 National Conference,
that's
the catalyst.
That was the watershed. Yeah.
Mm. That's what Daphne gave it. Gave us that way of looking and listening and to Aboriginal people instead of telling them.
Yeah. Mm. And a lot of people, I suppose. Again, it wakes them up, turns a light on, doesn't it?
Certainly turned mine on.
Shall I press the button?
Yes. Oh, you're good.
The red light doesn't seem to be going out.